The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from the Blue Cliff Record. One day a student asked Master Bai Zhang, "What is the extraordinary affair?" Bai Zhang said, "Sitting alone on Taxing Mountain." The student bowed, and Bai Zhang thereupon struck him. The verse. In the realm of the ancestors gallops a heavenly colt. Among expedients, rolling out and rolling up are not the same path. In a flash of lightning or sparks struck from stone, one retains. How laughable. A person comes to grab the tiger's whiskers. Good morning, everyone. So we're here this morning. There's been a BIPOC session led by Zenju Osho. And so we've been here since Thursday doing what we do. I read an article this week. We discussed it during the weekly monastic study, an article on loneliness, and that got my attention. And so I wanted to speak to that a little bit. What is the extraordinary affair? For 2,500 years since the time of the Buddha, teachers have been speaking about this in thousands of different ways. We can call it ordinary mind. We can call it reality just as it is. But why extraordinary? When a person is starving from hunger or dying from thirst or weighed down with exhaustion, then plain food, clean water, a bed, in that moment will never be forgotten. The teachings, it talks about someone who has been sentenced to jail or to be executed suddenly being freed. Extraordinary. But it's not just liberation itself that is extraordinary, but it's that which liberates. That which seemed to be the cause of our struggle now becomes the pathway to something extraordinary. The self, which, when we begin to really see it clearly, our attachment to it as binding, becomes essential to freeing ourselves of that. Bai Zhang says, sitting alone on Dajung Mountain. And so for practitioners, there are times where we sit in solitude. There are times where we sit together. But what is sitting alone? The footnote to that says, his awesome, majestic air extends over the whole country. Sitting alone on the mountain. Our discriminating mind, the mind that recognizes, pounces, names, compares, judges, likes and dislikes, keeps populating our inner world, right? Kuan Yin said we need to liberate the many beings in our mind. And so our mind, discriminating mind, keeps populating the mind and the body inside and outside with so many things, so many concerns, so many people, so many times, so many events. And so what we're asked to do when we come to sit on this cushion is something rather revolutionary. Having come with a great concern to free ourselves, a great concern about the state of the world, for a moment, for a time, to let that be. to leave those many things not so much behind, but just let them be. Not so much to put something down as just not to pick something up. Let the person, the self, one's life, the world, be by itself for just a moment while you are by yourself. And in that, to not build any walls. And when the self arises, don't pick that up either. You know, we're kind of addicted to activity, to being. And things do need to be done. Beds need to be made. Meals need to be prepared. Jobs need to be performed. Sickness is healed. Children need to be raised. So I was doing doks and I was hearing these voices out there. And I thought, oh, the folks doing the session are out there having a good time in the field. Then I realized it was the kids. So there are things that do need to be done. But is there a space, is there a time, even in an ordinary sense, to not do something? I remember once my dad was in the latter part of his life. He had cancer and he knew he was going to die of it. And he called me one day and he said he was frightened. So we spoke about his fear. And they lived in North Carolina, which he loved dearly, in a place surrounded by mountains. And I said, Dad, why don't you go out? You know, I thought, I'm not going to give him instruction in Zazen. That's not going to work. And I said, but why don't you go out on the deck where you like to sit and don't take a book and don't take a drink. Just go. And he said, do what? I said, don't do anything. I said, you love those mountains. They've been holding you all these years. Just go and be with them for a spell. And then in Zazen, to take that not doing into this extraordinary affair. Bai Zheng was one of the great teachers, eighth, early 9th century Chan masters. It's said that he sort of began the monastic rule in Zen tradition. Scholars debate that. But he was a very influential teacher. He was a student of Matsu, who was another really kind of luminous person within the Zen tradition. And one day he said, somebody asked him, how can a person gain freedom? And Bai Zheng said, well, first put to rest the various involvements in your myriad affairs. Don't recall them. Do not think about dharmas. Don't think about good or not good, mundane or transcendent. Don't think about the world and its troubles. Don't think about enlightenment. Cast aside, don't pick up the body and mind, and just let them be free. Let the mind be like trees and stones, without disputation or distinction. When the mind is free of activity, the ground of the mind is like the sky. The sun of wisdom appears of its own, and the sun emerging, like the sun emerging when clouds part. He went on to say, this mind like wood and stone, thoughts become spared from worldly entrapments. It's like a great elephant crossing a river, engulfed in the rapids, but not slipping. Heaven and hell cannot pull on such a person. When that person reads a sutra or observes a teaching, the words return to the person. It's beautiful. It's a way of thinking about what practice is. We enter, we engage these teachings from the Buddha, from the 8th century, from all the way back, from all the way into the present. We chant these sutras each day, and ultimately it's so that the sutra returns to the person. There's a point at which you're no longer chanting the Buddha's words, somebody else's words, somebody else's teaching, but it's your own living experience. So this mind, like trees and stones, Dogen said, two, he's quoting, he's actually referring to this. This is from his fascicle on arousing the aspiration for the unsurpassable. I mentioned that in the fascicle that we're studying, which is about raising bodhicitta, there's another fascicle that's named, is very similar, arousing the aspiration for not enlightenment, but for the unsurpassable. And they're both amazing. I thought about it pairing them together because they work so well together, but I thought it might be a little bit too much for us to give them both their due. So we just had the one. But from that other one, Dogen says, the mind is like trees and stones, referring to Bajang's teaching. What is called mind here is the mind that is thusness, things just as they are. It's the mind of the earth, the mind of the self, the mind of other. It's the mind of Buddha ancestors in every direction. It's the mind of heavenly dragons and other beings, like wood and stone. There's no other mind than this. And so clearly, this mind that he's speaking about is not your brain, doesn't live in your head. That's why in Buddhism, this question of mind, particularly in Mahayana Buddhism, is central. It's just, in a way, it's another way of asking, what is the nature of the self? What is mind? At its deepest level. Dogen goes on to say, the mind of trees and stones are by their very nature not cooped up in the realms of existence or non-existence, emptiness or form. With this mind of wood and the mind of stone, you arouse the aspiration for enlightenment, practice, and actualization, because your mind is wood and your mind is stone. Your mind is thusness, is the entire earth, the self and other. And in this, Dogen says, now, the porridge is enough. The rice is enough. The grass is enough. Water is enough. Each thing in and of itself is enough, sufficient, complete. I mean, just think about that in relationship to sort of the, you know, the view of samsara. Never enough. I mean, that's what we're basically trained to feel, to think, to live by. Never enough. I mean, if having billions of dollars or your own rocket shop or whatever is not enough, then it sure as hell, oatmeal and rice is not going to be enough. Grass and water is not going to be enough. From a Buddhist perspective, that is the fundamental illness. Everything flows from that. When we are not enough, when mind is not enough, when the world we live in is not enough, then we are out looking, trying to find that special something. And so Bajang says, sitting alone on Dajung Mountain. Right? So he's not just saying, go do zazen. He's not saying, make sure that no one's around you. There's something else going on. What is it to sit alone? The Buddha is said to have, at the time of his enlightenment, said, between heaven and earth, I and all beings attain the way. Between heaven and earth, I alone am the honored one. I alone. And the student bowed. And the commentary says, this student's bowing was not the same as ordinary bowing. The student had the eyes to see. Though they knew each other, Bajang and this student, they acted like they didn't. And this is one of just the unique, sort of wonderful, beautiful, challenging aspects of much of the Zen teachings, the koan literature, is that there's a language, there's a conversation happening on this level using ordinary language. There are things taking place, and there are other things going on. And in a way, that's always true. We have a conversation with somebody on. We talk about certain things. How was your day? Ba ba ba, and meanwhile there's something else going on. We're having an argument with somebody. Why'd you open the window? It's cold. I closed it. And we get into an argument, but there's something else going on. It's not really about the window. And so within samsara, there can be a similar kind of thing. We're using ordinary language. We're talking about something, but that's not really... That's going on, but there's something else going on. Here, within the realm of enlightened activity, they knew each other, but they acted like they didn't. And so the student is seen into, has to enter into the mind of Baijiang, in the mind of sitting alone, in the mind of this student bowing, which is a customary thing to do. When you receive a teaching, you bow. That's an appropriate thing to do. But here he says, this is not the same as ordinary bowing. What is the student communicating? When we sit alone on Tremper Mountain, Baijiang is saying, let the mountain sit as the mountain. Let alone sit as alone. Let sitting sit as sitting. The thing itself, nothing else. Nothing is left behind. Nothing is extra. So clearly he's not just talking about developing mindfulness, developing concentration. And yet, as we practice those experiences of silence, of stillness, of joyfulness, of release, of sufficiency, they're not what Baijiang is talking about is an extraordinary affair, but it's a little bit like when you're walking in the woods and you're really thirsty and you run out of water and then you hear something. Is that the wind and the leaves? And you keep walking and you realize, no, it's water. It's water moving. And so there's that sound. You're not there at the water yet. You're not drinking, but there's a sound that's calling and is speaking of something. And so those experiences we have of the development of our own mind, of our stability, of the capacity to let go, of to hold turbulence, right? Without becoming turbulent ourselves or reacting turbulently. It's like listening, hearing that those sounds of the river up ahead or further in. When the person sitting alone reads the sutra, receives the teaching, and the words return, they return to where they belong. You know, a lot of practices, because we come in, most of us, I'm assuming, didn't grow up Buddhist. We didn't grow up reading these teachings, encountering this. You know, I'm reading a book from an anthropologist, psychologist who's studying in Dharamsala, all of the Tibetan refugees who have resituated themselves there and have experienced tremendous amounts of pain and suffering in their lives and been witness to it. And how have they done that? How have they handled that? How have they met that? Like, what effect has that had on them? Within our culture, we have this, you know, science of psychology and understanding of trauma and how things get embodied and then appropriate ways of dealing with it. And she finds different things happening there. And that even with people who aren't Buddhists, they don't study Buddhism, they don't haven't practiced Buddhism, that they're so inculcated with Buddhist teachings and Buddhist language and Buddhist views that they just naturally sort of bring that to their own experience without even necessarily knowing that it's Buddhism. Sitting alone on Dajim Mountain. So there is a danger sort of inherent within practice. We sit, right, we come in and we're swirling with the world. And we hopefully care, right? We care. We're not just trying to get away from it, although there could be some of that. That'll get dealt with, don't worry. But we're swirling within ourselves, with the world, and we want something to change. And then as we enter into practice and we turn inward and we direct our attention to our own mind and we take responsibility for our own karma, there's a lot of inward directed practice, right? We're turning inward. When you go to sit zazen, you're not out there with the family or with the kids or other, you're choosing to be in this space, right? And that could be a withdrawal. That could be turning away from. It could be not taking responsibility, not participating. But it's not intended to be. It shouldn't be. And as a person goes deeper and begins to really experience the true nature of things, to be attached to things is illusion. That the very sense of self that arises is just a sense of something. It's like a breeze passing by. It's like a cloud passing overhead. It has no substance. There's nothing that needs to be built up. There's nothing that needs to be deconstructed. There's nothing that needs to be defended. There's nothing to cling to. That can then become another trap. Hakuin says, too often the student clings to this and will not let go of it. This is called stagnant water. Such a person is called a spirit who keeps watch over a corpse in a coffin. Even though they remain absorbed in this state for 30 or 40 years, they will never get out of their cave of self-complacency. So it's very interesting, right, how being self-concerned, my suffering, and wanting to free myself of that, I experience the basis of my liberation, which is there is no self to attach to cling to suffer. I'm liberated from that. And what do? I cling to that. I do the very thing that has created all of the suffering all along the way, and now I direct it towards the thing to which I cannot attach. Because it is not a thing, so I attach to an idea of it. Because we're always attaching to an idea. And so Hakuin says, therefore, as long as they remain in this hiding place of quietude and passivity and vacantness, the moment their bright insights, that is, whatever they've experienced, comes into contact with differentiations, defiling conditions of turmoil and confusion, agitation and vexation, love and hate, i.e. the world, life, they will find themselves helpless. And all the miseries of existence will come rushing back in. So Buddhism understands this. It's how the medicine becomes the poison. And that's why training continues. That's why practice continues. That we're not just here to have an experience, but to keep going and keep letting go and keep freeing that which has become stuck. And so this mind like wood and stone that Baijiang and Dogen are speaking to, it's not a mind that is inert or frozen or hardened. It's just the opposite. It's pliant, spacious. The mind of wood and stone is the self-nature of wood and stone. It can appear, disappear. It's all-inclusive. It forsakes nothing. That's why Dogen says, this mind, this nature is thusness. It's the same mind as the entire earth. It's the mind of self. It's the mind of other. It's the mind of every Buddha ancestor in every direction. It's the mind of heavenly dragons and in every kind of being. There is no other mind. There is no other nature. What is the extraordinary affair? Baijiang says, sitting alone. And so the monk bows. Not an ordinary bow. Baijiang strikes him. The commentary says, observe how when they let go, they both do so at once. And when they gather back in, they wipe away the tracks and obliterate the traces. So there's this notion, it's kind of an aspect of training. It can be like a teaching tool. Holding back, gathering back, he calls it, is in the teacher-student relationship where the teacher becomes inaccessible. Usually it doesn't start there. It starts with letting go, where the teacher is very present, very supportive, very affirming, helping the student to gain trust, to understand how to practice, you know, to be sort of that reliable guide that the student is looking for. And then as the student gains confidence, as they're developing, then there are moments of gathering back where the teacher becomes less accessible. Right? Dr. Roshi used to talk about, you know, the student standing, everything's fine, they're standing on a rug, and the teacher pulls the rug out and the student falls down. What they were relying upon, something that they were attached to, the teacher steals away and they fall. But then they stand up, teacher rushes in, helps him stand up. What happened? Oh my goodness, helps him stand up. Until they're steady again, then they pull the rug out again. They fall. And they keep doing that until the student doesn't fall. The sutra has returned to the person. The training has returned to the person. Falling down and standing up have returned to the person. They have merged. And so he's saying that in this, there is gathering in, taking everything away, there's rolling out, meeting each other. So in this article on loneliness, and some of you might have read it, it was in the Times, it just talked about the growing number of people in the U.S., but also in other parts of the world, that are experiencing sort of self, you know, identifying with loneliness. And that it's, as you know, the Surgeon General, a few years ago, last year, called it an epidemic of loneliness and isolation, which is a very technical thing for the Surgeon General in making that statement with 71 pages of advice that puts it in the same realm as diabetes and obesity. In other words, it's a health issue. It's a health crisis. It's not just a feeling. And it talks about how loneliness is a compound or multidimensional emotion. It can contain elements of sadness, anxiety, fear, heartache. And in all of those feelings, right, there's a very strong sense of someone feeling those, having those emotions. I am sad. I am alone. I feel isolated. I'm afraid. I'm anxious. And that's true. That person is. I am having those experiences. Buddhism never denies that. It affirms the experience that we're having. And then it asks us to examine, but what is that? Because it seems to have a kind of power. When I am afraid, fear within me has an effect on my body and mind, on my actions, on how I hear, how I respond, what I see, what I do. It's as though that emotion has a kind of own being, a kind of self-power. Because when it's not there, I don't have those responses. I'm not afraid. And so when it shows up and seems to then affect all of these changes, so this is happening to me, this emotion somehow that I know is my emotion, it's in me somehow, but it's doing something to me. That's just an expression of what we call a self, having its own independent existence, its own power. And so in those emotions, which are valid in the sense that we're experiencing, it comes with the sense that they have some existential power that is affecting me, and I am the one who is affected. And the more I have those experiences, the more I'm almost certainly going to begin to identify, I am someone who is lonely, who is sad, who is anxious, who has heartache. And it talked about how the it's particularly strong in younger people. And I mean, little wonder, given the world that we have given our young people. You know, can a young person today with confidence say, the world is my oyster? It's an open door. I see just all kinds of possibilities, a bright future. And it talked about how governments in the West, in the East, different countries are trying to address this, you know, by public awareness campaigns. Find a hobby. Get interested in something. They said in Britain, they're encouraging people who carry the mail to knock on doors. How are you doing today? Have a conversation. When I was growing up, our mailman, being a mailman was the first job I ever wanted to, it was my first career dream. Because we had a mailman who was a really nice person. He'd come, he'd deliver mail, we'd sit on the stoop, have lemonade, chat. He got to wear shorts. And I thought, my dad didn't get to wear shorts going to the office. And I thought, I want a job where I can wear shorts. He got to walk around and give people what I assumed was all just good news. I thought, that'd be a cool job. Just go around and give people good news all day. So that's what's being encouraged. Not all of that, but just how are you doing? And it said that, you know, that's all based on the idea that all we need to do, that loneliness, the solution is just a phone call away, an email, a text, a knock on the door. Just a little bit of connection. And so, but it's really misunderstanding how we live now, how so many people live now. And at worst, it's a distraction from the real issues. It says, when we talk about loneliness, what we're really talking about are all of the issues that swirl perilously underneath it. Alienation, isolation, distrust, disconnection, a sense of loss of a sense of trust in institutions, traditions. It referred to some evolutionary ideas of loneliness that in order for us to survive in our early years, when we were, you know, it was us and these massive animals who could run much faster and had claws and teeth, and, you know, we were just out. We couldn't meet that as a solitary being, right? So we had to form groups. We had to gather together and work together. And as a team, we could do all kinds of stuff, right? And so we developed the essential capacity, the need, the survival skill to work together, which means we had to learn how to deal with the things that would prevent that, that would divide us, that would put us into conflict with each other. And obviously, we're still working that out. But there was part of our evolution, which is kind of fascinating to think of. You know, that being a social being wasn't just, you know, in our, well, it became part of our DNA, but it was really how we had to be in the world to survive. And maybe that hasn't changed. Maybe it's just as true now as ever. And he talked about how loneliness can become a self-fulfilling prophecy. So a person desperately wants to not be lonely, but fear and anxiety they might have convinces them that their loneliness reflects a fundamental undesirability. I am unworthy of social connection, of love, of friendship. If it's fundamental, even though we may not think of it as being I am, that's like my intrinsic nature, we can experience and feel that way, right? I'm sure we've all had that experience. We just feel like, I am this. We may not sort of examine it at that deep level and realize the implications of that, but we can be functioning in that way. And in that, then there's really not a lot we can do. If it's our intrinsic nature, then that's just the way we're built. We can distract, we can cover up, we can mitigate, we can fight it, but that's just who we are. And the Buddha realized that's never been true, and it's not true of anything. There's nothing in the world that exists in that way. If a person is absolutely certain that they're not worth talking to, that no one likes them, that they're not a good person, and that it's their fault, he says it's like the mind is being hijacked, taken over. And he talks about the traditional places, going back probably to forever, that there were places where people met, congregated, talked, related to each other, lived, did things, rituals, ordinary, conventional rituals, like sports, music halls, theater, and religious things, churches, and so on. And then talks about a survey last year where 20%, 1% of the U.S. population considers itself or says it is doing anything religious. That's a lot of people not. And I wondered about that. You know, is it that people just aren't interested? You know, cat videos are just way more interesting and fulfilling. You know, that's my spiritual practice. It's cheap. It's inexhaustible, apparently. Or is it that there's something not being provided? Is there something that is needed that is not happening? So there have been places throughout history where people gathered and they stood together in moral values. They engaged in each other. Children were raised. Stories were told. These traditions that have, in a sense, got us here. And now they're just kind of helter-skelter. And then I was thinking about this in relationship to the three treasures. Right? Or any analogous, comparable constellation of goodness. Not in any one person's life, but in a community's life that exists such a way that people will come to that as an antidote or medicine or sort of the primordial and essential aspect of being a human being. How do we deal with our isolation? By not being isolated. How do we deal with our distrust? By getting together and cultivating trustworthiness. Being trustworthy to ourselves and to each other. How do we deal with a loss of faith? By cultivating faith. How do you cultivate something as intangible as faith? It's a reasonable question. Where does it come from? Right? Something has to be touched. Something we have to come into contact with something that comes into contact with something in us. The sutra has to return. We have to realize on some level, even if we don't understand it, that we are not here just to make a bed and just to cook a meal and bring home a paycheck. There has to be more than that. People have always wondered about that, human beings. So that when we are making a bed and preparing a meal and working to support ourselves and ours, that there's a deeper sense of what's going on there. There's an underwriting, an undercurrent, a foundation of not just why I'm doing this, but what is this? Who is this? How do I do this in such a way that it is meaningful? It quoted that within the young people who feel so disaffected, that a lot of young people said they just didn't see anything in the world that seemed meaningful. And so we have to experience, come into contact with something that is meaningful. And not just meaningful in the sense of ideas, but that is actually making contact with us. That if we're feeling helpless, we have to engage in something that helps us, introduces us to our power, our agency, our capacity to engage in something that has consequence. If we're feeling hopeless, we have to learn how to be inspired and inspire ourselves. If we're feeling distracted, we have to find a way to deal with that distraction, right? If we're feeling disengaged, then there needs to be something we can engage with. If we're seeing sort of a sanctioning of immorality in the highest places, and we can very easily just become cynical and think, well, you know, nothing matters, obviously, then we need to encounter the power and the strength and the beauty and the joy of a moral character. Any of this sound familiar? This is what the three treasures are. This is what we have entered into. This is what we're constantly being invited to engage and return, have returned to us and realize, oh, it was never missing. To appreciate how when Buddhism talks about causes, actions, individual actions, actions within a couple, within a family, within a community, within an organization, within a nation, the world is being changed in those actions. The world is being influenced. Minds are being changed. It's not optional. It's not like, well, I don't believe in karma. Fine. I don't believe in gravity either. Fine. Right? You jump out of a tree, gravity will come to meet you. If you pay attention, karma will show you. Is not asking you to believe in it or not. It's just a natural functioning thing in the human world. And so I was just thinking about this and obviously appreciating the treasure of the three treasures of Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. And why didn't the Buddha, after all of his years of such intense searching and struggle, I mean, to even think about those years when he was practicing asceticism. It's really unimaginable for most of us to even imagine going through that oneself. And then coming to this most profound freedom, enlightenment, liberation. And then what did he do? He immediately, well, after a period of days, he wanted to share it. And he thought, who would listen? Who would be interested? Who could hear this? And then he spent the rest of his life just doing the same thing, sharing that, which didn't necessarily make his life easier, right? It made it more complicated. That was his gift. And so I just think about how what we are, good fortune, but also just those elements that we are in the midst of. That's why I thought it was important for the monastics to examine this and discuss this, because we live in this world, we live in this society, the world flows through. Loneliness flows through. To understand it, to be able to meet it, to identify in those different ways, to recognize what we actually have available to us and appreciate it. So I wanted to end with a poem. I did performed a wedding yesterday for Chion and Rhonda, two Sangha members, which was really lovely. And I wrote a poem for them, and I'm going to take a little bit of that, some excerpts from that. And because I thought, as I was reflecting on that yesterday afternoon, that it kind of ties in. There is a road by which we came to today, ever straight ahead on an ever-turning path. Let's call it faith and careful attention. Let's call it love. There's a path that leads away from here today into what is not yet ours to know, because this is not a way of prophets or fortune tellers. Rather, this is a path of travelers into worlds of vast and ordinary. Let's call it patience and generosity. Let's call it trust and careful attention. Let's call it kindness. Now, let us leave behind our cherished certainties and enter the door that we have chosen. It is ours to enter. It is ours to discover. It is ours to give. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.